Thank you very much. So this is work that I have been doing with one of my heroes, Paul Wilson. My co-author is a magician, and he has a TV show in the United Kingdom called The Real Hustle, which I discovered by accident just because I was recording something else, and this came on at the end, and I watched it, and it was much more interesting than the other thing I was recording. And then I started following this program religiously. Fortunately, it was the first season. It's now in the seventh or eighth season. And then I decided I must contact this guy because although he's in a totally different field, we think about security in the same way. And then eventually this work came out of that. So the problem we are facing is that, okay, there are systems and there are people like us who are engineers by training and who devise technical defenses for protecting the system from bad guys. And largely, the security engineers do the defenses based on their model of the world. And the difference is that the logic of the engineers is not the same as the logic of regular humans. And so the real users behave in ways that the engineers did not predict. And therefore, this link in the chain, the human link, is what often makes the whole system vulnerable, as we all know. So we really need to understand why users do what they do, because as engineers, it's well demonstrated that we don't. And if we don't do that, we are not going to be able to defend them properly. So what is the aspects of the psychology of users that make them behave as they do and therefore make them vulnerable? Well, I don't know. We should perhaps consult some experts about that. And who are the experts about the psychological vulnerabilities of users? Well, the experts are those who have learned how to exploit them, so the fraudsters. So the whole thrust of this work is learning the psychology of fraud victims from the people who know all about it, so the fraudsters. And this TV show that Paul and his colleagues, Alex and Jess, do in the United Kingdom is about looking at scams that exist, so to say, in the wild, and recreating those scams against unsuspecting victims with hidden cameras rigged around. They do all the same things that the real hustlers do, and then at the end, when the person has, you know, lost all their money or whatever it is, they send the BBC crew and say, "You look very distressed. What's happening to you?" And they say, "Oh, so this guy came and this happened and now I lost all my money." And they say, "Oh, that is how sad." And then they explain, "Actually, it was us from the BBC. And you know, and if you don't mind, would you sign this disclaimer so we can show this so other people can avoid being scammed by the same scam next time?"
Do you get your money back?
They do get their money back. So, yeah. That's some of the things would be difficult to replicate in a kind of, let's say, university study. It's a good guy to partner with because he gets to do all the dirty work. So, maybe I'm getting too far. The contributions of this work are essentially threefold. First of all, documenting existing scams. That's the body of work of Paul and his co-authors on the TV show, because he's now into the, I think, seventh or eighth season, and each season is 8 to 12 shows, and each show shows something like 4 or 5 different scams. Then he's into several hundred scams that have been reproduced and documented. And the second contribution is to abstract away from the individual scams, because not all of these hundreds of scams are totally original and independent. There are commonalities, obviously. So I spent lots of time in front of the TV taking notes on the various scams. Which way does this scam exploit the victim? What bad things, what weaknesses of the victim have been exploited in this case? And then classifying them into bins and extracting principles out of that. And then finally saying, okay, it's all very well for these small-scale scams, but can we, as security engineers, take some lessons out of it that we can apply in a more broad sense. These are three things of this work. So all this exists in the form of a tech report of the University of Cambridge. Looks like this. You can download it from my webpage. Just type my name and surname into your favorite search engine. And the paper is structured like this. There's basically a matrix of scams. The lines are scams. And the columns are principles that we extract from the scams. So each one of these, series 1, episode 1, series 2, episode 3, series 4, episode 5, this is some video from the TV show. And we highlight which principles I'm going to describe are of major importance for this scam. That's the black dots. And the hollow dots are the ones that are also used, although they are not of primary importance. Now, of course, this matrix is quite full. Even though I have 1.5 hours, it would not be possible to go through all that. So I'm going to choose some representative scams that I'm going to show you videos for. And then we are going to discuss which principles are demonstrated in those scams. So first of all, you should learn the language of this. And a good way to do that is this book, The Big Con. It's a book from the 1940s. This is a recent reprint from 1999. It's been reprinted recently. And this guy, David Maurer, was a professor of linguistics at the University of Louisville. And he was fascinated by this world of the confidence tricksters and made friends with many of those people and studied the special language that they made up for themselves. Most types of criminals have their own language. And so this book is a documentation of all the tricks that they play and all the special ways in which they call themselves. And the confidence trick is making a story that the victim will believe to find an unmissable opportunity through which he loses all his money. The victim is called the mark. The operator is the one who does the scam. And then the shills are the extra characters that the operator recruits to make it all seem believable. This book here, The Big Con, was inspiration for this famous movie, The Sting. And I guess, how many of you have seen The Sting? Okay, so everybody knows. So when you have at the end that scene inside the bookmaker, everybody in the bookmaker is a shill, except the guy who is finally fleeced. The roper is the guy who brings in the mark into the con, and so on. And if you go through that, at the end of the book, there's several pages of just this fun lingo. So all this stuff is timeless. I mean, 1940 is this book, but all this goes back for centuries, and this is why it's interesting for us to study, because computers largely didn't exist in the 1940s, but all this stuff that the many computer frauds are based on is based on things that go on in our head that have been going on for centuries and for more from before our civilization, even when we were still monkeys. So the first one I'm going to show you is a time-honored thing. You may have seen it played in the streets of New York or whatever on a cardboard box. It has infinite variations. There's three cards or three leather discs or three shells. And it's a simple game of trying to figure out where the winning of three items is. And if you bet on it, you receive even money if you win. And if you lose, you lose your money. And that's a surprisingly common occurrence for reasons that we shall now see.
The team are in Manchester's fashionable Canal Street, full of modern clubs, cafes and bars. Will any of the clientele be tempted by one of the oldest con tricks going? The This is the three shell game. In this case, played with three bottle tops and a pee.
Come on, folks, try your luck. Anybody want to play? It's very simple. Real money for real luck. All you have to do is find the pee. Very simple, always starts there. You're going to move them around like that.
Paul is the operator, or the shell man, and he's looking for a victim.
Come on in. Come on in. Don't just look. Stand over there. All you got to do is guess where the pee is. It always starts there. All right, where is it now? I haven't done anything yet. Like that. Perfect. Just like that. Watch. There's the pee. You know where it is. All I'm going to do is move them around like that. I'll do it again. You know it's not there. Where is it? It's not there. It's not there. It's got to be there. Now, sounds like fun, but it is for money. You want to have a try?
Yeah.
Maybe for some money, £10?
Alex is a collaborator in the scam known as a shill. He is going to pretend to play the game and so entice the victims into...
Even money paid, you give me a tenner, I give you 20 back.
All right,
where is it now? There it is. I'm going to try and confuse you. A little bit of that. Where is it?
Middle one?
Look at that.
Sweet.
You got a winner. All right. 10, 10.
Alex wins, and so the victims are conned into believing that they can succeed too. But the reality is that they don't stand a chance.
All right. Move them around like that. What? Bring the money out your pocket. What you got? Come on. Don't listen to her. She doesn't know what she's talking about. Feel the luck. All right, a tenner. Tenner for which one?
Middle one.
Tenner
20,
for the middle
20
one.
On this one. 20 on that one.
I've got to take the bigger bet.
20 on that
I've
one.
I've got to take the bigger bet. Look. It's over there. You should have listened to this guy. He knows what he's talking about. Do it again. This one's for you. Watch.
Hey, it's the money.
Alex loses, but this is all part of the plan to make the real players think that they are smarter and so are more likely to win.
This one there. Show me your money. What have you got? Make it 20 so he doesn't come over the top of you. Come on. Make it 20. Right? You shouldn't listen to me, mate. I already know it's over there. Look. We'll do it again.
Jess is another shill, and she is there to squeeze more money from our victims by pretending to cheat for them against Paul.
Okay, one more time, where is it? It's right there, yeah? All right, I'll do it for you this time.
Jess leans in and whispers her plan. She will mark the bottle top that has the pee under it with a smear of lipstick. If the players pick that one, then they can't lose. Of course, we know that they can't win.
All right, it's in the middle one. Go on, then. Don't drop it now.
Jess leaves a tiny mark on the bottle top with her lipstick.
Can I check it, just in case you... Yeah, all right, I know where it is. Now watch, very, very slowly, OK? You know exactly where it is. Where is it now? Come on, show me the money. Show me the money. What have you got?
20 quid.
20 quid. 20 quid on this one.
No, that one.
That one?
That one.
20 quid on that one. How much are you betting?
20.
On this one?
10.
This one?
That one.
How much? 20?
20.
Well, it's not there, mate. It's over there. Like that.
The victims have now lost £40.
Was that you?
No.
With barefaced cheek, Paul accuses the players of cheating, which allows him to close the game and keep the money, as well as seeing off his victims before they realise they have been conned.
This is a game for money. You can't cheat.
Look,
okay?
I got nothing.
I'm sorry. No. Sorry. All right. I'm done. If you're not going to play fair, I can't play you. I'm sorry.
Okay.
All right, folks, try your luck. It's a game anybody can play. Very simple.
Paul is up for snaring more players, while his victims have time to reflect on their defeat.
Well, initially, when I first went to have a bet on it, I didn't really think I was spending any money, but when the girl kind of, like, said, with his lipstick on it, that's going to be it. You kind of, like, assume, you know, how can it not be any different? So... I guess because of the girl's presence made me spend a bit more money than I would have done.
Paul, Alex and Jess are conning another pair. But even if these two choose correctly, they can never win. A skilled shellman uses sleight of hand and other tricks to always take...
Which one? That one you should have said over there, mate. Sorry. That's how the game works. Sorry, guys.
The shell game is centuries old and people are still falling victim to it all over Europe. The problem is, they will never win, as this game relies solely on the hustler's sleight of hand.
This is called the shell and pee. There's no pee here. There's no pee here. The pee starts right there, like that. Nothing under here. All you have to do is watch for the pee. Here we go. If I wanted to, I could put the pee here. Or I could put the pee here. But he, of course, is right there. And that's why you lose.
Okay. So you've seen at the end that there is some sleight of hand trick that Paul plays. And you could be excused for imagining that that's how you win money out of the marks. That's not true. I mean, you may have met people who claim to know how the three cards game is done. So, you know, there's a way of switching the winning card with another card. And I can show you, and I can they do it, of course, not as nicely as a real scam artist. And say, I know that, so I could beat the operator if I wanted to. But in reality, they stand no chance, because there's always more tricks up the sleeve of the scammers. They can, as you have seen demonstrated in the video, if you actually guess the right one, they will overbet you. One of the shields will put more money on another one so that they have an excuse for not taking your bet. They have ways of making you confident that you definitely have the right one, as we saw in the lipstick. With the cards, they can bend the corner of one card, and a skilled operator can switch the bend from one card to another, and so on. There's also the old-fashioned extra recourse of having some of the shields pickpocket you while you're riveted on the game. So you can't really beat the game, because it's not a game. It's just a polite way of mugging people. So here is the first principle that we extract from... See if I could get rid of that. Yeah, if only I could get rid of this tough thing here. Right. It's not quite a substitute for a full keyboard. So the first principle is the distraction principle. While you are distracted by what retains your interest, the hustlers can do anything to you and you won't notice. So this applies at several levels to what we have just seen in the Monte game or the Three Shells game. There's the fact that you are looking at something and some sleight of hand takes place. They make you look at one of the shells and instead something else happens on another shell. At another level, it's also happening that you are looking there and someone else is picking your pocket. You didn't see that in the video, but that's also commonly done. And in every instance of sleight of hand operations, the distraction principle is fundamental. Pickpocketing is one example, but also magic, which you can see as a kind of benign scam done for entertainment reasons. You always have the magician directing your attention somewhere when they don't want you to look at the place where the actual switch is taking place. If we come to computer systems, then always a winning strategy for male marks is to employ a sexy distractor. And one of the most famous, basically very stupid viruses was this I love you thing, which was some letter that went around, and it's alleged to have caused $5 to $8 billion of damage worldwide. And the reason why people opened it is because the virus writers, compared to their competitors, had put in a little bit of psychology as to how to entice them to open the letter. There's many, there's gazillions more examples of people playing on this, of course. If we look at the field of security and usability, which has gained some interest in the past decade, then you can see that this is a prime case in which the distraction principle takes place, because what happens is that you have a user who's focused on doing something practical, for example, accessing his files. He's at the conference and needs to retrieve his presentation for Last Dutch, and it's on a server back at the university. And then he's faced with some some wall of SSH or access control or some other bullshit which doesn't work suddenly. Why? Ah, and the user is in great distress because what he needs is to get at his presentation before 2 o'clock. Otherwise, he'll be really in trouble. And the last thing he thinks about is that the nice system administrator back home is trying to protect him from having someone else access his files. Damn system administrator, why does he put all these things in my way? I need to get out of it. And that's where the job of the system administrator is made hard by the fact that he's then perceived as a nuisance or an enemy from the user, who instead should be his partner. So the user is so focused on some completely unrelated task that he completely forgets to protect himself or to cooperate with the one who's technically capable of protecting him. So if the system administrator goes overboard and makes a very complicated access control system, so a very inconvenient lock to use, then what happens is that the user doesn't use it, finds a way to bypass it, and then everybody loses. So another case in which this happens is the 419 Nigerian scam. You get distracted by something else, and I'll have more to say about it when commenting some other principle. And you could say, I mean, many people, that, you know, we talk to people about how stupid people must be for falling for a 419. You know, you must be really gullible not to notice that this is a scam. But it's not just the gullible who fall for the distraction principle. I have a wonderful story from Frank Abagnale, the guy who was played by Leonardo DiCaprio in Catch Me If You Can. How many of you have seen Catch Me If You Can? Okay, so you know what I'm talking about. So this guy did most of the things that were in the movie, went to prison, as in the movie, became a highly paid security consultant, and wrote books. So he writes this book about stuff, some consultancy he did to some big bank in 1999. So in 1999, people's main worry was the Y2K bug. Okay, so they had all these very sophisticated three-letter persons like CTOs, CIOs, CFOs, C-star-Os, and they take him at a tour of their facilities, and he looks and sees legions of programmers in front of these COBOL terminals. He says, I didn't know you had that many programmers. So the CIO says, oh, these guys from India, they said, they're really sharp and they're cheap. We just hire those people to fix our COBOL because otherwise we wouldn't get it done in time for the millennium. Their thinking was, says Abagnale, these guys know computers, and they're inexpensive, as were a lot of other offshore firms from India, Russia, and Taiwan that were fixing Y2K problems. But I knew that any dishonest programmer could easily implant a so-called backdoor. So the CIO is just as gullible as the 419 victim because he's totally focused on, I have to cover my ass before the 31st of December, and I have to get anything possible done so that the Y2K bug doesn't make me lose my job. And never mind that I have all these hired hands all over my source code. So the lesson from systems, and you know, systems in the widest sense from the distraction principle, is that when the victim is focused on something, is distracted from other things, and therefore is not paying attention to the protection that you may hope to offer to them. Another principle that we extract from the video we just saw is what we call the herd principle. So in this case, you have other people doing something. You may suspect that what is going on is slightly dodgy, but other people are also doing it, so it's probably okay. Even suspicious marks will let their guard down when others next to them appear to share the same risks. Safety in numbers, not if they're all against you. In this case, all the other people behaving the same were shills. Well, in this case, we had two shills. In bigger operations, you can have any more. And notice also how the behavior of the others can be used to make a quiet exit from a dodgy situation for the scammers. So this wasn't demonstrated in this video, but imagine other situations where the victim senses that something bad has happened. And then, so there was another scam in another video that I'm not going to have time to show, where they swindled a couple who was on holiday in Spain out of their money because they pretended to exchange the money at a favorable rate, and instead they stole all the money and they gave them something with paper inside it instead of real banknotes. And then when they noticed, it was the guy who exchanged the money who did that. And one of the shills was there pretending to also have lost a few hundred dollars, the same as them, and said, this was really bad, but this is the Spanish mafia is here, and they're going to break our legs if we go to the police. We better just, take this as chalk it up to experience and leave. And, I'm also losing the $300 here, but it's better to lose $300 and keep our kneecaps and all that stuff. So cooling down the mark after the scam is also one function of this bunch of shills. So eventually, thanks to the herd principle, they will behave as induced by the behavior of all the others. As we move to computer systems, we see, for example, in online auctions, the system pioneered by eBay, where people can report how their trades went and leave positive or negative feedback. This is something that was done to allow interaction with people that you don't meet. But of course, it's something that can be rigged using the herd principle. You just make up plenty of fake identities and then pretend to have good transactions so they have stars of the right color. And then at the time you want, you hit your mark with a good scam. And this happens in many systems. Sock puppets is the name that is used for multiple identities in contexts where you, for example, are arguing several sides of a discussion and you want to pretend that several other people share your view. Or in that case, I'm rethinking that maybe this must be, there must be some wisdom to this if so many people agree with this guy. Astroturfing is an interesting term. The etymology comes from the fake grass, and it means preparing an audience for political grassroots support of a party. This is the pun that's implicit in the etymology of that. The sibyls is something that's used for the same multiple identity in peer-to-peer systems. And just the fact that there are so many names for this practice of making extra principles that support your view, that convince someone else that that's what they should be doing, shows that essentially all multi-user systems are subject to this type of fraud, where the fake identities induce the victim to behave in a certain way. So let me show you another video that is going to illustrate these other principles. So some of you may have seen this talk before, and I have shown this video, and I'm going to show a slightly different but essentially isomorphic other one called the lottery scam.
With odds of 14 million to one against winning a jackpot, the chances of hitting the big time on the national lottery are almost non-existent. But the chance of a mark winning against our team of hustlers in this next scam are even less. This is the lottery scam.
In the lottery scam, we convince the mark to purchase a worthless forged lottery ticket.
The lottery scam is a beautiful example of an age-old con game applied to modern times, where you literally offer someone a golden ticket, where if you buy this, you can make a lot of money for a lot less.
Jess, Alex and Paul have picked out a popular bar as a place to find a wealthy mark for their scam. With our secret cameras at the ready, the hustlers can strike. A man sitting on his own has been targeted. Paul has taken up position behind him, and Alex is standing by with the fake lottery ticket. The hustlers are preparing the hook.
You look just like one of my ex-boyfriends. He's called Marcus. It's so strange. When I saw you, I was like, hi. It's so strange. You look just like him.
I'm not sure that's a good or bad.
No, it's good. No, it's good. I promise you.
Now the mark is putty in Jess's hands. Our hustler, Paul, who's been listening from the next table, cues his colleague Alex to go in for the big pitch. Alex is playing the role of a Bulgarian builder who's a friend of Jess's and has come to meet her.
Yesterday, I found out that I won £2,800 on the lottery.
No!
Yes,
I get five numbers. I cannot believe it. I call everyone. Tomorrow I'm going back home to Bulgaria.
What a great way to end your last day there.
I know, isn't it great? Look at that. It's fantastic.
So, over the course of 5 minutes, Alex has sold the lie that he's a foreigner with a winning lottery ticket. Now he needs to convince the mark to buy it off him. It's time to reveal the bait.
You don't work for the police, are you?
No.
Okay. No, it's not a joke.
You
it sounds like, you know that my work permit is finished 3 months ago. And when I check the number, I find out that you have to go with the ID.
Okay.
Okay, if they see my ID, I'm worried that they maybe see the...
Do you want me to cash it for you then?
I thought maybe if you have the cash. Sorry, it's a financial conversation. For
the whole of it?
Yeah, do you have it?
Do I have £2,800?
15 minutes ago, the stranger was having a quiet drink on his own. Now two hustlers have sat down at his table and started chatting about a winning lottery ticket. It's a weird situation, but he's definitely intrigued.
Find anyone who's got...
Look, I will take less if somebody's helped me out. You know, I know you maybe less money and you keep some money for yourself, I don't know, 1,000 or something.
Now that Alex has said he'd accept £1,000 for the ticket, he gets up to leave the table. As planned, he's left Jess clear to play the next part of the scam, the all-important phone call to the Lotto results line.
I haven't seen someone happy for ages.
Alex has told the mark the ticket has 5 correct numbers and is worth £2,800. But there's a surprise in store when the numbers are confirmed.
And the bonus, 28.
What?
He's got 28.
What?
He's got 28. That's the bonus ball. Oh my God.
Are you
shitting
me?
No.
Shh. Hang on.
Jess tells the mark there's been a mistake and the ticket actually has 5 numbers plus the bonus ball, which is a much bigger prize than 5 numbers alone. The mark is then given the opportunity to confirm the numbers for himself. These are the numbers on the ticket. The mark is now hearing the actual numbers drawn in the lottery. Now the mark thinks that the ticket is worth over 100,000 and not the 2,800 Alex told him initially. This is the key to the whole con. The fish has bitten. It's time to reel him in.
I want to buy it off him.
That's harsh.
Yeah, but you don't know him very well, though, do you?
So?
No, he's always scrounging off my brother. That's why I'm not bothered at all. Oh, my God.
Jess has planted the seed. She wants to buy the winning ticket for £1,000 and she needs someone to go halves with her.
No, it seems a bit cheeky though, it's like nearly £3,000 and it's 500 quid, but...
Do you have a friend maybe who can...
I don't know, I mean, could you get some money out maybe?
She practically forces him in as a partner in ripping off Alex the foreigner. In fact, he's the one about to be ripped off.
Change big mess.
Yeah.
A big mess for me, but...
Well, I can nip out and get some cash with the cash machine. Do you want to come out and...
Yeah. I'll have a look with you.
Yeah.
I trust you. Your name is?
Danny,
okay, no problem.
Finally, the mark agrees to at least go to the cash point with Jess. But will he really stump up the money, or will he give her the slip? The hustlers wait nervously to see if the sting will fail or succeed.
I'll give you a minute.
After 10 minutes, the mark has returned. But is he bearing the cash?
$500.
Bingo. With the mark's £500 cash now in Alex's possession, the scam has succeeded, and the mark is left with a worthless lottery ticket for his money. Game, set and match to the hustlers.
The lottery scam works because the mark, the person who's going to be conned, essentially thinks they're going to make X amount of money, and that's a pretty good deal for them, and they're thinking, well, maybe I should, maybe I shouldn't, whatever. But then they find out, actually, as long as they're prepared to lie and keep quiet about one element, then they stand to make far more money than that. So in terms of the psychology, you've anchored them at a certain profit, and then suddenly they find out, actually, they could be sitting on an absolute fortune. And that just appeals to their sense of greed. That's why it's such a fantastic scam.
Okay, so the first principle we get out of this little show is what we call the dishonesty principle. Your larceny is what hooks you. Thereafter, anything illegal you do will be used against you by the fraudster. Everything you see in that book, The Big Con, hinges on this one, exploiting the fact that your victim actually doesn't mind doing something slightly dishonest, so long as he's not found out. And he understands that that's why it's such a good deal, because you can't get such a good deal if you just do regular honest things. But maybe this is the chance of his life to buy the Mona Lisa or something. So the same principle was in action at the time of cheating the Monty operator with a lipstick or with flipping the corner of the card. You know, I thought I had the good one, then he ripped me off. I'm sure something's dodgy was going on because I saw the P was in that one and instead it was there, but now I'm going to have my own back and I'm going to put more money in it. And that's just the dishonesty principle. He wasn't doing it by himself. He was just invited to do that by just putting on the lipstick, but then he was biting. How many of you have seen, to continue with movie references, Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels? Okay, maybe half. Okay, in that movie, it's not part of the main plot, but there is a point where the characters are in a very tight situation because they owe money to someone who will kill them if they don't return the money in good time. And they rack their brains for ways of making a quick buck. And one of the characters comes up with this wonderful scheme. He says, okay, let's pretend that we are a mail order sales firm, and we have the best anal vibrators on the market, right? So they're imports from the US. They know their stuff. So it's the movie. So the guy says, you know, we put this ad in the back of some gay magazine, and we have the wonderful sensation, new imports, and blah, blah. And we put them some fair price, and the guys send us their checks. We make some company name like Bobby's Bits, something that, you know, doesn't indicate anything. But then when we get all the checks, we have enough. We say, sorry, we didn't get enough of the imports, and we have to return your money for the moment, and when we get more stock, we'll write back to you. And you send them a reimbursement check with another company name, the R. Stigler's Faggots Fan Club, which makes it quite less likely that they will go to the bank to cash the refund check. And the interesting thing about this scam is that actually they are not even doing anything illegal because they are prepared to give them their money back if only they go and cash it, which they don't. So for illegal, you can also read embarrassing here if you wish. Anything embarrassing you do will be used against you by the fraudster. But the first part depends on the victim actually wanting to do something naughty. So in the big cons that are described in the book, I mean, the ones that I'm showing here are, for necessity of time, just short cons, the ones where you get what your victim has on themselves. But the big cons are where you set them up, and for days and weeks and so on, you make them go back home and mortgage their house and bring everything back and so on and so on. So to set them up for all this, you have to ignite their greed with using their dishonesty. And this is precisely what happens in the 419 Nigerian scam that I mentioned earlier. So you have someone who writes to you, you receive one of these in your email two or three times a day, I'm sure, and there's this Nigerian prince who wants to bring his inheritance out of the country and doesn't want to have it taken away by the customs officers or find something in the bank and so on and so on. And so long as you, foreigner, with a foreign bank account are prepared to help, then he's going to give you 20%. Of course, he's going to keep 80%. It wouldn't sound plausible if he split 50-50 with you. So you say, ah, yeah, I understand. You say yes to that, and there's some fee to pay. You have to corrupt some officer to do the first part of the scam, so you send some money, and then when that's done, oh, but there's another stop, and so you have to send some more money to clear that, and so on, until they figure that they have milked you of all the money you have. And they are very effective at going step by step for, making you start low and then eventually giving all that you have, including maybe even what you don't have. People have remortgaged their houses and things like that. Now, one of the subtle and deadly tricks about this is that you realize that what you're doing is naughty. You realize that you are doing basically money laundering. So once you figure out that was a scam, I have been robbed, you say, I don't really want to go to the police because they might arrest me for money laundering. Then I'll be even worse than now. I mean, lose all my money plus go to jail for 10 years. So there have been reports of victims who killed themselves because they couldn't see a way out. You know, I've lost all my money, I can't go for help. And of course, if you did go for help, then the police would say, yeah, another one of those. They wouldn't necessarily put you in jail to try and find a way out. But all the stuff is done in a way that you understand that what you're doing has some bad consequences that might hit you back. So more and more examples of ways to exploit the dishonesty principle. Restaurant credit card fraud was a reminder of another subtle psychological trick that went on some 10 or 15 years ago, where you would go to a restaurant and pay by credit card, and on your credit card statement, the bill for the restaurant wouldn't appear. And the next month, it also wouldn't appear. And the next month, it also wouldn't appear. And you say, maybe they forgot. Maybe they mischarged. That's good. And you know, hope that nobody finds out. Hope that the restaurant just made a mistake and never realized. And then a while later, you get hit for like $10,000 worth of casino chips or something like that. The nice thing about that is that it makes it very difficult to link the two transactions because they have your cooperation because you don't investigate the fact that you didn't get billed by that restaurant. But by the time that they actually hit you a few months later for the casino chips, you've forgotten that you had not seen that thing. You are their accomplice in not owning up to having to pay that restaurant bill, and by that time, they then do something that is much harder to trace for the visa investigators. So if we look at this from the viewpoint of systems, then maybe one interesting lesson here is that, you know, if the person has done something bad, they're not going to be very willing to own up to it. So if you are the system administrator and in your network you have found that there's been an intrusion because someone downloaded a Trojan, maybe while they were something that pretended to show naked women and things like that. Imagine the situation of this guy saying, yeah, it was me who inadvertently brought in this Trojan because I was just looking for porn on the net during company time. Of course, the retribution that they might get might put some incentive towards not owning up to being the people who brought that in. So I think one lesson here is if you actually care as system administrator about doing the forensic and figuring out what happened and maybe having a chance of tightening up your network, maybe an amnesty, a preemptive amnesty, is going to gain you more cooperation if you take into account the dishonesty principle. Otherwise, if you also promise to punish them, how is it going to work? I'm reminded of something I just saw the other day when I went to Washington has some wonderful museums. There's one about currency, the Bureau of Engraving and Printing. So they had leaflets about the new $100 bills and how you can find a counterfeit note and so on and so on. And they say, if you have a counterfeit note, you have to give it in to the police. And if it was actually genuine, they'll give it back to you. And if it wasn't, then they're not going to give it back to you, so you're going to lose out. And don't try to pass it on because that's illegal and blah, blah. You can argue any way you like, but it doesn't seem like the incentives are set in such a way that they will encourage people to give in their banknotes under such circumstances. Another principle that's illustrated by the video we saw about the lottery is the need and greed principle. Need and greed make you vulnerable. Once hustlers know what you want, they can easily manipulate you. We originally called this just the greed principle in the first draft of our work, and then we decided that this had an unnecessarily moralistic connotation. So greed means you're bad. But it's not just that. It's just there's something that you really want, you really can't do without some visceral trigger, like in the same way as hunger. I mean, you're not bad because you're hungry, but you just can't help it. If someone waves in front of you something that you really, really want, then there's nothing you can do about it. That's why we switched to calling this need and greed. And, of course, the sexy swindler that we saw in the first principle is another example of that. You just wave in front of the mark what you obviously imagine they really want. And once you know what someone really wants, you can scam anyone, even if what they really want doesn't exist. So another good scam that Paul demonstrated was making a gadget for recharging subway cards. In London, you have a subway card that is an RFID card that can be recharged, and it can hold hundreds of dollars if you want, if you're a frequent traveler and so on. And he was selling a box with a switch and an LED which would recharge the card to $50 every time you put it on. So he gets the Mark's card, puts it on, flicks the switch, the LED comes on, and then they check it in a machine, and now it has $50 on it, so do you want to buy this gadget? And of course they buy the gadget for a lot of money, and he had just switched the card, being the magician and sleight of hand expert that he is. So even if the thing they want doesn't exist, like a thing that recharges the cards, you can still sell it to them if you realize that's what they really want. So if you know what people really want, I mean, those who have been to the same talks as I have this morning, some discussion was, okay, what about if I am a security-minded person and I want to exclude Flash because I think there's too many exploits on Flash. So lock it down, no Flash, or no JavaScript, or no any other form of executable content in your browser. Okay, then the user goes somewhere that doesn't work unless you have Flash or JavaScript or whatever, and it's going to be the user who is the inside accomplice of the site that sends in the malware, because he's going to be the one that opens up all the locks to let it in. Now, a very nice story here is that a smart sysadmin of some place that I shall not name, once offered on the intranet a substantial number of gigabytes of soft porn so that the students, would not find the need to go out and get it and incur not only substantial transatlantic charges for the usage of the internet, but also go to sites that might have loaded on their computer more than just the soft porn. So I thought that was really smart. So what we need to take out of this from a systems viewpoint, in my opinion, is that those who design a system must understand the user needs and what the users really want in order that they can predict the behavior of the users. And if they fail to predict what users will do, then they will lose the battle to those who actually understand them, namely the fraudsters, of course. Now, another principle we can take out of that, it was subtly demonstrated in this one, but is more heavily present in several others, is the time principle. When you are under time pressure to make an important choice, you use a different decision strategy. And the hustlers steer you towards a strategy that involves less reasoning. So if what you need to do needs to be done right now, or the opportunity is no longer there, then you can't quite reason it through all the way. And there's a guy who won the Nobel Prize for debunking economic theories of people behaving completely rationally in their choice, and saying, look, organisms, and I'm not just talking about humans, but even animals and stuff like that, they don't just run through all possibilities. They are designed to simply do what's good enough in the situation. Because if you try and run through all the possibilities, then the dinosaur might be there and eat you. So you just need to do what you need to take your choice before the impending danger occurs. So quick decisions are going to be based on some heuristic, which works most of the time and saves you most of the time. Sometimes it's fallible, but on balance, it's better than trying to reason it through all the way. And because the heuristics are fallible, then the hustlers make you use a heuristic and then exploit the cases in which it fails. In the UK, there's a piece of legislation that reflects this very clearly. It's called the Consumer Credit Act. I think I got this wrong. It's called the Some Other Thing Act, and it means if someone comes to your home and sells you double glazing, and in your living room they make you sign something, then after they leave you say, did I really want double glazing? No. And then you have a period of 1 or 2 weeks to say, well, I didn't really want that. If you go to the shop that sells the double glazing and you buy it there, then you don't have that. But if someone comes to your home and puts pressure on you because today there's a 40% discount only until the end of today, then there's legislation to allow you to renege on that if you later figure it out. So sorry for this. I forgot the real name of the act, but this must be a different one. So this time pressure that people put on, in this case, you can see this is something done by salespeople. So there's a kind of gray area between real fraudsters and sales technique. And I think that one of our duties is to, you know, keep on reevaluating what, I mean, this may not be illegal to put time pressure on people like that, but it's dubious whether it is ethical. And I think that as a community, we should keep an eye on these things. And as, marketing methods evolve, we should reevaluate what is allowed and what should be allowed. Now, how do we counter something like that? The military have some human protocols that they wrap around dangerous, urgent situations. And you are forced to behave according to a series of steps before, for example, shooting on an intruder. You have to call out in a certain way, wait for a certain response, and so on. And if a number of ifs match, then your orders are to shoot or whatever. If you have to launch the nuclear missiles, and you know, who has seen that other movie, then you know you have a sequence of steps to take if the order comes in, first of all, to authenticate the step, and secondly, to actually do it. And this is a situation in which there is enormous pressure, both of responsibility and of time, and you can't expect the person to behave rationally and do the correct decision. Therefore, the protocol wrapped around this takes out some of that responsibility and some of that pressure because there's only fixed ways in which to behave. And this, for a systems guy, is something that would be a good lesson, I guess. Try to figure out cases in which your potential victim is going to be in a time pressure situation and try to take out some of the time pressure by wrapping it in an appropriate human protocol. Cases of emergencies where people might have to make an impromptu decision. If this can be identified at design time, then remove the impromptu from the decision. And now another movie to demonstrate yet another principle, social compliance, which others may call the authority principle.
The hustlers have selected a small high street jeweler's as the perfect place to stage this scam. Unbeknown to the shop staff, our hidden cameras have been placed inside to cover the following action. Jess enters the shop first, looking well-dressed and respectable.
Hi.
Hi.
Oh, God, it's so cold.
She approaches the counter and talks to the staff about wanting to buy a new necklace.
Silver.
Alex comes into the shop shortly after. He is apparently just another browsing shopper. And where's the third member of our team? Paul is outside ready to step in on cue.
Got a nice one here.
After some browsing, they show Jess a necklace that takes her fancy.
That's the sort of length.
Yeah.
How much is this one?
It's quite expensive, actually.
£624. Yeah, that's really cool.
The necklace is worth around £600, which is a suitable bit of swag for this scam. Jess seems happy with the choice and says she'll buy it.
1, 2, 3, 4, 600. 1, 2, 3, 4.
As she finishes counting the notes, Alex swoops in.
Okay, stop there, police.
What?
Walthamstow Police. Tracy, I'm placing you under arrest for deception and fraud. Leave that money on the counter. Please let my colleague in, please.
Flashing a fake police badge, he arrests Jess for passing counterfeit money. Will the shopkeepers buy his act?
We've been following her all day. There's been counterfeit cash. She's been passing it off for jewellers. Yeah, go ahead.
The shocked shopkeepers have bought his line and the hook and sinker too. The hustlers insist the cash is forged and must be bagged as evidence. In fact, it's the gang's own hustled bankroll and it's actually not forged at all.
It has to all go in for evidence for her. I'm afraid that's part of the evidence as well now. You will get it back, obviously.
And there it is. Alex, the fake copper, has convinced the shopkeeper to bag up the £600 necklace as well.
I can ask you just to pop that in here. Thank you.
It's all going to plan. With the necklace bagged, the scam is complete. Our team of hustlers have cleverly choreographed a theft worth £600 from right under their noses.
Bitch, you could have cost me my job, you know that.
Yeah. Beatrice.
The hustlers leave the shop, claiming to be off to the police station.
Okay. I'll be back in an hour. I'm going to take a full statement from you, because obviously it'll go down as evidence for her, yeah?
Had this been a real scam, it would have been the last time the shopkeepers ever saw their expensive necklace.
Of course, the best bit is when the jeweler says, you could have cost me my job. Right, so this principle of social compliance, wonderfully demonstrated in this scam. Society trains people not to question authority, and hustlers exploit this suspension of suspiciousness to manipulate you. In this case, they were impersonating police officers. They can impersonate any kind of other figures of authority, just wear a fluorescent jacket and steal somebody's car and things like that, just wear a waiter's uniform and steal their credit card, wear a hotel uniform and get them to give you their room key so that they can be checked because they're just reprogramming the system. Oh, yes, of course, and by the time you come back, there's nothing left in your room, and so on and so on. Now, you would think that the people who are into a hierarchy, like, for example, the military or the police, would be the ones who understand who to obey or not. And Mitnick, a very famous social engineer, written wonderful books about that, demonstrates how this is totally false. So this is from one of Mitnick's books. And he says, okay, people in law enforcement, like people in the military, have ingrained in them from the first day in the academy a respect for rank. So he demonstrates how they are even better subjects for falling to the social compliance principle by calling on the phone the National Crime Information Center and pretending to be another officer who's being asked by his captain to do something that day immediately, and please help me because blah, blah. And just by knowledge of the lingo and the procedures, you know, he can fake his way on the telephone, and the other guy very helpfully, yeah, yeah, okay, I'll get you out of this. And he gets information that they're not supposed at all to come out of this database, you know, confidential data on some person that was there. Just done as a demonstration that as long as the social engineer is posing as a sergeant or lieutenant, a higher rank than the person he's talking to, the victim will be governed by that well-learned lesson that says you don't question people who are in a position of authority over you. Rank, in other words, has its privileges, in particular the privilege of not being challenged by people of lower rank. So also notice how people suspend judgment when in front of authority. You know the Milgram experiment? Yes, that's the one where they were giving electric shocks to people, pretending that it would make them learn better. And the people who were being experimented on were the ones who were administering the fake electric shocks. And the experimenter was able to make most of them deliver quasi-lethal shocks of several hundred volts. And they were not questioning the fact. Yeah, well, they were sort of questioning. Yeah, but what happens? The guy is screaming. Yeah, continue. And they would continue. The guy is fainted. Continue. And they would still continue until the end of the scale. So people suspend judgment when in front of authority in a way that we would not expect when we are here comfortably sitting in a conference room. Now, imagine one case where social compliance happens in computer system, and that's the situation of phishing. You have some authority, your bank, it's an authority because it holds all your money, and it tells you, I mean, it looks like your bank is telling you, go and change your credentials, update your login and password, otherwise you might lose access to all your money. So, okay, I'll go and do that. And notice also the double jeopardy in which the victim is placed by the fact that on one hand the security side of the bank says, never click on URLs in email. And at the same time, the marketing side of the bank sends them email with links that say, please get a mortgage from here. So, you know, what's the user supposed to do? So, I guess the lesson for a systems person is that we should align the incentives and the liabilities with the overall systems goal. Decide what you want the people to do and then put them in a position where they can actually do it. So, if you want users to be suspicious and to be questioning a possibly fake authority, then make it possible for people to challenge the authority. If you are against a policeman who says, please do X, and you start questioning, say, well, can I please check your badge and so on, and then what happens is that they haul you off for resistance to an officer, then, of course, your best course of action would be not to question the authority and go ahead with it. Then in that case, you should be absolved of responsibility if you have got it wrong. And the same in a computer situation. If you want the people to question what happens in case of possible phishing, then you must make it possible to argue and detect and so on and so on. And in the case of a computer system, make it technically feasible for them to tell the difference as well. This is related to the next principle I have here, which is deception. Things and people are not what they seem. Hustlers know how to manipulate you to make you believe that they are. And this is a principle that is very general. In fact, it underlies practically all scams. All scams are forms of deception. It is so general, although it does apply to many situations, that we are deciding to remove it from successive future editions of this work because it is just everywhere. So for a computer system, think, for example, of the problem of authentication. Mostly, it's we think in terms of the system having to authenticate the user. But many times, we also have to take into account that the user must authenticate the system. And that's the relation with what I was saying earlier about phishing. So there, the failure is because the user fails to authenticate the banking site, fails to tell the difference between a genuine and a fake banking site. Now, there is a technical measure in the form of the HTTPS, which you can spot. Is this a site that has a certificate that tells me that it actually is the bank and blah, blah? But first of all, can a non-geek do that? Can a non-geek understand? And secondly, do the people at the bank understand that? I argue that usually they don't, because if they did understand it, they wouldn't put the HTTPS on some domain name that's completely unrelated to the bank. I mean, they would. The most highly valued asset in this psychological perspective is the name of the bank. So you should put www.nameofmybank.com, the place where HTTPS says this is a certificate for this bank. If you put it www. Dot some completely unrelated domain that's doing the authentication for me because I farmed it out, then even a user who's gone to the trouble of understanding HTTPS has no chance of authenticating or validating whether this is the right site or not. So from a systems viewpoint, I guess the lesson for us is don't just make it possible to get it right. Make it so that it's extremely unlikely to get it wrong. Okay? Don't just give them a very rare, very difficult to hit possibility of getting it right. And especially don't blame the users if, honestly, they don't stand a chance of doing the thing properly. So I am told that I have only 5 minutes left. I have here, this is a summary. We have seen just three scams, and they demonstrated these principles. There's plenty more. These are scams that are described in the tech report. Many more, of course, exist in the TV series. And so I had here a sneak preview of some ongoing follow-up work that we are doing, including identifying other principles in other in the work of other researchers. And just you tell me, do you want me to skip that and just go to conclusions and your questions, or do you want me to go through that? I'm open to either. Okay? Hands up if you want me to continue with this. Okay. So in that case, let's see that. Preview. So the question we had, okay, we've done the fraudsters. What can we do next? Let's study the salespeople, because there's actually very little difference between the fraudsters and the salespeople. I mean, the only difference we could see is that sometimes what the salespeople do is legal. So as we were finding ways to look into that, someone pointed us at this wonderful book, which you should all read if you enjoyed today's talk, Robert Cialdini, Influence, Science, and Practice, fifth edition. Fifth edition shows it's good. This is maybe another scam. So jokes aside, this is a really wonderful book, and this guy is a psychologist, and an experimental psychologist. Some of his experiments involved becoming a covert salesman. So he pretended to just wanting to be a recruit for people who were selling cars or vacuum cleaners or stuff like that, or encyclopedias. And then he was getting the training. You know, this is how you get people to buy one more encyclopedia. And in this book, he distills his experience, the experience of all the readers of the previous editions who have written to him and so on. And he also, like us, extracts principles, except, you know, we are very amateurish in this case. We are not psychologists. And he has all the ways of validating this in the ways that pass muster in the psychology field. And it's interesting to see that the principles he extracts for the salespeople and what he calls other compliance professionals, people professionally make you comply with what they want, his principles are similar to ours, and some of them are exactly the same, some of them are related, and some of the ones that he has and we don't have apply to us, and some of the ones that we have and he doesn't have also apply to salesmen. So, for example, he tells a story about salesmen for making a certain point. He's trying to make the point that there's an implicit equation that expensive means good. And this is how these these crafty tailors exploit this perception for basically selling a suit to a guy. So there's two brothers, Sid and Harry, who run a men's tailor's shop. And he says, whenever Sid had a new customer trying on suits in front of the shop's three-sided mirror, he would admit to a hearing problem and repeatedly request that the man speak more loudly to him. Once the customer had found a suit he liked and asked for the price, Sid would call out to his brother, the head tailor, at the back of the room, "Harry, how much for this suit?" Looking up from his work and greatly exaggerating the suit's true price, Harry would call back, "For that beautiful all-wool suit, $42. Pretending not to have heard and cupping his hand to his ear, Sid would ask again. Once more, Harry would reply, $42. At this point, Sid would turn to the customer and report, "He says $22. Many a man would hurry to buy the suit and scramble out of the shop with his expensive equals good bargain before poor Sid discovered the mistake. So you can see how this thing that Cialdini describes matches our dishonesty principle. So he's scamming the customer by making him think that he's getting an unexpected $20 discount that the tailor was not prepared to give him, but in fact it was all staged. So I have another movie here to demonstrate two principles that are there. I think somewhere else I have a shorter version of that movie, so I'll give you just the 2-minute version, because oops, we're otherwise out of time. Let me find that. No, I can't see anything from here. See if I can go through here. The radio is maybe here. Maybe this one.
Excuse me. Hiya. Do you know how to change a tyre by any chance? You do? Could you help me, please? I haven't got a clue what I'm doing. I managed to jack it up and that's about it.
The scam is on. Their willingness to do a good deed has just made these motorists the marks.
Jacked it up properly? Is it off the ground?
I guess so, yeah.
I'm not really know how to do these things. Is it not? You need to do that more.
After standing here so long in the cold sea breeze, Jess is naturally feeling the chill, so she has one more favour to ask of her new friends.
So, can I be really, really cheeky? I've just seen you coming. Has your car got a heater in it?
Yeah.
Do you mind if I just go quickly sit in it and make a phone call? Is that okay? Yeah. I'm absolutely freezing. Thank you. I can just watch what you're doing. Oh, thank you. Do you you need...
Of course, she can't run the heater without the car keys.
Thank you very much.
Just that green one over there.
Thank you.
I'll be 2 seconds. I'll have to go for my dad.
Being a gent, the Mark does the honourable thing and lets Jess wait in his car to warm up. Though he's keeping a good eye on the damsel in distress and his car, while his girlfriend gets her hands dirty. But the moment his back is turned, this good deed goes bad.
Right, where's the car then?
What?
Before he realises what's happened, the Mark's car is gone. And he's not happy. So why has Jess stolen his wheels, leaving her own perfectly good car behind? Because it was never her car to start with. Let's take a look at what really happened.
So, of course, there's going to be some explaining to do for the Mark when the real owners of the car arrive and see it jacked up. Anyway, so the reason I show this one is because it demonstrates a principle that we found in Cialdini called the commitment and consistency principle. Once we make a choice or take a stand, we will encounter personal and interpersonal pressures to behave consistently with that commitment. This is something you see also in the 419 again. So you start to do something and then something else. You're like, well, yeah, but I've already said that yes to that, and you continue and you go on. And some say, oh, you're very strong. Yeah, I'm very strong. You're very strong. Well, right, then how about carrying all my packets? So another principle that we came up with after working on this for a while, this is not one of Cialdini's, but it's also demonstrated by this video. This is the wrong way. Is one we call the kindness principle. And it's essentially the dual principle to the dishonesty principle. In dishonesty principle, we said, okay, we can scam people by exploiting the fact they're dishonest. In this case, we can scam people exploiting the fact that they're nice. People are fundamentally nice, and they are willing to help. And hustlers shamelessly take advantage of it. So this is what happened in the case of this video. They just asked for help, and they were kind enough to help. And then, of course, very dishonestly, the hustlers stole their car. But notice the interplay of the two things, because if Jess had just asked, can I go in your car and keep myself warm, they would have never said yes. But if they start with a small kindness thing and then leverage it on using the commitment principle into, okay, now you've started helping me for jacking up the car, can you also help me doing that? And at that point, it's harder to say no. Then there's another principle that we found in Cialdini that certainly applies to scammers, which is the reciprocation principle. When someone does something kind to you, you will be compelled to return the favor so as not to be in their debt. So many a sale or a scam will start by giving you a present so that you're more inclined to say yes. So this is a chart that I will mostly skip, saying our revised set of principles, where they came from, and blah, blah. This is another study that also has some relevant material done by the University of Exeter. And it's in the references of my tech report. So, conclusions. As I said at the start, there's three contributions to this work. First, we recreate and document hundreds of existing scams in the TV series. Secondly, we extract principles about how the victims behave, the 7 principles plus the 3 ones that we have shown now at the end. And then we move from analyzing the short cons to system-level protection. So stuff that we might do in the future, there's many directions this could go, and it's a highly interdisciplinary research area. When I present this to audiences of programmers, then what they say is, okay, give me more things that I can do. Give me a checklist. Of course, we believe that giving people a checklist is absolving them of responsibility of thinking. So a checklist is not the best way to go about it. The best way is to make them think like the user and make them think like the fraudster. Models of decision-making to figure out why people work in a certain way. This draws on from many disciplines, and validations of those models in several ways, experimental psychology, and most exciting for me, neuroscience. So I teamed up with an old pal from when I was at St. John's College in Cambridge, who was a neuropsychiatrist and is now putting people inside big fMRI machines and making them do fancy things while they're in there and checking which parts of the brain light up. And so he's with Paul Wilson, these other people and me, we are investigating the reason why we fall for scams. So we've seen how we behave. Why do we do that? It looks like we should have an evolutionary disadvantage for falling for scams. That surely there must be some good reason why we do all that. So this is my last slide. And if you forget everything else, this is what you should remember. You cannot make a system secure if you don't understand the vulnerability that are inherent in being a human that uses the system. And the fraudsters are the ones who understand, and let's be humble enough to learn from them. So this is the take-home message. It is arrogantly idiotic to whinge that users are gullible. What happens is that the engineers will say, I had designed a secure system. You only had to do X, Y, Z, and if you had done that, then the system would have been secure, which is equivalent to saying, look, when you walk, all you need to do is just put your legs like this, okay? Then walk, you put one foot and the next foot, one foot, the next foot, and then you'll be safe, okay? And your hands will keep the balance like that. So you can make a system that, if people follow your instruction exactly, it works, but nobody's going to follow your instruction for more than 1 minute if they are completely unnatural. So certain behavioral patterns are human nature, and smart system designers will not try to negate them. They will acknowledge them and prevent their exploitation because they are going to be there anyway. Thank you very much.
So I have a question about trying to do this kind of work in a university where you have an institutional review board who, if I said I'm going to go like scam people and put them on television, making them look really embarrassed, there's just no way my IRB would ever allow me to do this.
He's at Cambridge.
So how do you pull this off?
Well, this is why I chose as my partner someone who's not in a university, no IRB board, and he was doing that anyway.
So, Frank, as you were talking and demonstrating your principles, I had this sudden flash that things are about to get a whole lot worse. We have a whole bunch of things that are converging right now. Particularly in the U.S., we have an administration and our political system and even our social system that is working toward making us more compliant and obedient to authority, more accepting of just straight authority. At the same time, we also have technology that's giving us things like targeted ads. So when you have forced compliance, unwarranted searches and seizures, you have ads that are targeted to a particular individual's psychology. I don't see right now an easy way to defend against this. I think things are going to get worse.
Yeah, I'm afraid you might be right. But it's a challenge for us to try and anticipate this before it just makes the headlines. Okay, this guy got scammed, this guy got into this trouble. Can we just think one step ahead and find ways to prevent that? I would like us to do that as a community of people who care about this.
Yeah, my way of thinking of the last sentence there is something I've been saying for a while, which is that the more security decisions that a system requires that a user make in order to be safe, you know, and the more active participation the system requires that the user have in order to keep them safe, the less likely that it is that the system will work. And ideally, the system should not require that the users take any active action in order to be safe. Because most of it is because, as you've aptly demonstrated, people just are not programmed to be constantly paranoid and couldn't even function. I suspect that most of these behaviors are actually there because they're necessary. If every time a stranger came up to you you know, and asked for help, you know, you said no, then a large fraction of the population would probably die off because, you know, no one would help them get to the hospital when, you know, when they'd broken their leg or what have you. You know, this, a lot of this is actually kind of necessary
yes,
sorts
I,
of
I
things.
I agree with you.
Do.
And in fact, what we said when we were speaking of the time principle is that we have some heuristics which are there because they help us most of the time. And then it's just the malice of the attackers that exploit that tiny fraction of the time that they don't work. They drive us towards that.
Yeah, so
but the heuristics are useful in 99%.
Yeah, so I feel like if we set up the systems so that they require that people, and like my favorite problem is you know, logging into your bank with a password. You know, you have to make sure that you have to look up and check that you have the correct URL, check that it is HTTPS, check that that you're actually getting a real CA and not, you know, and not, you know, some you know, the some third world government's CA that happens to be in your certificate, you know, in your browser certificate authority cache, et cetera. You know, and after all of this, you know, you can type in your password. And if you have systems which are set up so that you have to make 20 decisions before you're safe, clearly it's not going to work. And this is all just showing that it could never possibly have worked. And what were we thinking when we designed things this way?
Yes. Thank you.
Any questions?
Thank you kindly for that great presentation. How many scams are there totally that you looked at, rough number?
When you say looked at, you mean presented on the television show? Described in the technical report?
In both.
In the television show, there's several hundred, like 400.
Okay.
Order of magnitude.
I was
In the tech report, it's about 20.
I see. Have you done any studies where you've showed people the scams, and can you scam them a second time? In other words, after someone has sort of shown how it's gone, and then you try to do it to them again. I was just curious if any work has been done on it.
A very interesting question. For obvious reasons, the TV show has to have some entertainment value as well, and it's impossible to have someone do it on the TV show again, because, of course, they would imagine that they're being set up, which is the case. But from the viewpoint of psychology, there's an interesting result from that report that I mentioned in passing here from the University of Exeter, this one here, where they found the counterintuitive result that people who have fallen for a scam, instead of necessarily being wise to the scam again, there's a small but non-trivial proportion, like 10-15% of people who are much more likely to fall for a scam again. And I was discussing this with my neuropsychiatrist colleague, and he said, we should investigate this more because I think that there's a way that their brain works, which may be, you know, they are more inclined to believe things and things like that. There's some kind of, gullibility propensity that is being exploited by scammers if they can identify who is one of them. And in fact, even I think, if I'm not mixing things up, I think that even in this 1940 report of the underworld, he was saying the bad guys pass around lists of people who are known to be suckers and continue. You know you can have a good one with this guy as soon as he's made some more money again.
That reminds me, a number of years ago, many years ago, I saw James Randi, the pseudo-psychic or psychic debunker, talk to a room like this. And at the beginning, he said, how many of you believe in parapsychology or paranormal stuff and all this? And then he gave demonstrations to debunk everything, and then he asked again. And what was really interesting is more people believed at the end, after they had seen how all this was bunk, than believed at the beginning. Now, would people who see the scams actually maybe, like you're saying, maybe they're more likely to fall for it even after they watch the TV show? Because they think they're smarter and can outwit it?
Let me underline. It is not the case that by seeing the scam, then you're more likely to fall for the scam again. It is the case that a certain proportion of people, you can show them the scam many times and they're still going to fall for it. They still think that they can remake their money the next time or something like that.
Have so much invested in it and they want to get their investment back out
Yes. You may want to speak in the microphone for other people. You ask, isn't this because they feel that they can now make their money back, right? So there's an element of that, and there's also an element of saying, ah, now I know how it works. Therefore, I can beat it. Like I said, happens with the Monty scam. It says, yeah, I know how the move goes. Therefore, you know, I know which card to bet on. And they don't understand that it's not about the move. It's about everybody else being there, and therefore, this time they're going to place a bigger bet somewhere else and make you go for another round, and you would have won that one, but they didn't let you do that.
I think we have to run there. I'm very sorry.
Thank you very much.